This is Sam Darmacena, and you're listening to CJRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative.
So much of the conversation on entrepreneurship focuses on tech startups and on high growth firms, and on a certain image of entrepreneurship and what an entrepreneur can look like. And this picture is not complete. So we wanted to map the full spectrum of entrepreneurship and creative practices, from illustrators selling stickers on Etsy to DJs to internationally competitive like video game, film, and design firms.
That's Nisa Mali from the Brookfield Institute, which is a policy and applied research institute housed at Ryerson. They've been in operation for about 5 years now.
And we are a small interdisciplinary team. All of our work is public facing and published, and meant to be open access and usable. So it's not locked like some academic research is. And our mandate is on the innovation economy and innovation policy. And my work in particular is leading a research stream that puts an inclusion lens on that. So it asks who has access to opportunities in the innovation economy, what are the distribution of risks and benefits.
In November 2020, the Brookfield Institute released a report titled A Portrait of Creative Entrepreneurship and the Creative Economy in Canada. It was co-authored by Nisa alongside Stephanie Fielding, so I chat with Nisa about the report, the arts more broadly, and where the Brookfield Institute will go from here. The 62-page report is organized into essentially five sections. The introduction sets the scene, then it explores how we define creative entrepreneurship. From there, it investigates the economic impact of creative content, labor, and entrepreneurship. It touches on policies, programs, and business supports, and finally, there's the conclusion and a space addressing further research questions. Each section of the report also has a dedicated gender and intersectional demographic analysis.
So whenever you are researching something to do with people, whether that's workers, investors, founders, business owners, it's important to look not just at what they're producing and where they work, but at their intersectional demographics and characteristics. Otherwise, we don't understand who's in these roles, who has access to these opportunities, or parse out inequities in pay, participation, and advancement. The focus on women is that like initial demographic analysis comes because we know that arts, entertainment, and recreation and the information and cultural industries have some of the highest rates of women-owned incorporated businesses, but they still lag far below 50%. And we know that there's significant income disparities for racialized, indigenous, and female artists and creative workers, and at the intersectional demographic, the intersections of demographics between these groups. Like we know already that the gender and other intersectional demographics are an important lens here. And I don't think we're gonna see the full picture of what's happening in the sector without looking under the surface at that.
Like Nisa said earlier, our mainstream image of entrepreneurship is incomplete. So I asked her what a creative entrepreneur looks like.
And from national data and from other research, we know that the most creative workers are contract workers or gig workers. They're not permanent employees. And that kind of work involves its own kind of entrepreneurship. And we know that arts workers and artists have much higher rates of switching in and out of freelance and employment. We also know that there's high rates of hybrid employment in the sector where workers run small businesses or freelance artistic practices on the sides of their day jobs. And so entrepreneurship in the creative sector is really varied. It ranges in size. We see it across every kind of artistic practice and at every scale from freelancer to large firm.
Nisa also defined the creative economy for me, though she admits that it is tricky.
If you ask Statistics Canada, they would say it's the arts, entertainment, and recreation sectors and the information and cultural industries. But we know that creative workers and artists and creative practitioners are seen across the economy. So we have designers that work for large banks. We have copy editors and translators and copywriters working for tech companies. And so if you're going to get a full picture, you need to look not just at where the businesses are located in the economy, but also where the workers are.
While there's so much variation, Nisa explains why it was important to acknowledge all types of creative entrepreneurship in their recent report. Rather than zeroing in on the group of gig workers or internationally competitive firms.
Because this is our first report in this space, it was really important to capture that full spectrum of practice, in particular to help myth bust what an entrepreneur is and what it looks like to have a creative business. I think future work will be able to be a bit more focused and deep dive into particular either sectors or types of businesses. We also know that it's not static, that people move throughout their careers in different kinds of entrepreneurial practices within the creative sector and within creative work. And trying to get a full snapshot of that seems really interesting and really important.
And if reading a 62-page report is not your favorite way to learn, Nisa recommends starting with the short case studies that are found throughout the document. Each one is about a page long.
So throughout the report, we had short snapshots of some select sectors. Within the creative economy, we looked at video games, fashion, design, performing arts, and collective and co-op models.
For example, in the case study around collectives and co-ops, a concept that exists across the creative sector, the report discusses T-Base, based in Toronto's Chinatown, and how it allows creative entrepreneurs to have greater control over the production and distribution of their creative products, as well as counteracting some of the competitiveness and individualism often found in entrepreneurial culture. And since the report was published in 2020, we talk about how the entire creative economy has shifted in response to the pandemic and what that meant for Nisa at the Brookfield Institute.
So like many researchers, our whole team has had to adjust how we conduct research in the pandemic. For our quantitative research, or we relied on data, we temporarily lost access to some Statistics Canada data that requires researchers to be physically present in a secure data center. On our qualitative research, we've had to shift focus groups and workshops and interviews online. We've mailed out data collection packages to our qualitative research participants. And we've had to find ways to replicate our usual in-person collaboration practices virtually. For this project, it meant that the data we were using from the 2016 census was just wholly out of date. The landscape has just fundamentally shifted for creative practitioners and businesses and arts organizations. And so we opened the report with a letter from the editor, from the authors that spoke to the current context. And my co-author and I wrote that over the summer, and every time we wrote it, we'd have to update it. It's like right up until publication, we were having to adjust the numbers because we're constantly getting new information and data, new programs are coming out or changing. We wanted that to be as up-to-date as possible.
In the published letter from the authors, Nisa and Stephanie talk about new programming and mediums that are making arts and culture more accessible to those with a fast internet connection and home devices. But it's not compensating for the full loss of income to individual artists, arts organizations, and creative businesses. They also talk about the fact that so much is a mystery still. What is clear is that the sector remains culturally, socially, and economically vital, and that there is a need to understand the contributions and operations of creative labor and entrepreneurship, and to creatively imagine a safe future for performance, collaboration, and convening. So with all these shifts happening, Nisa tells me that the Brookfield Institute will keep exploring these concepts and building on this initial report.
So we are, I think this is going to be an ongoing area of work for us. We've done quite a bit of research on the tech sector and tech workers. And I'm personally really interested in doing a parallel piece of work on the creative sector and creative workers. So we're interested in measuring the impact of the sector, the spectrum of entrepreneurial practices within it, the experience of workers and businesses, and in particular, what's happening in the context of the pandemic. So how are arts organizations and businesses changing their practices? How are people coping? How are they grieving and mourning the loss of those collective and in-person communal spaces?
And even as we were chatting, lots of questions and ideas were coming up for her.
I mean, we've certainly seen, anecdotally, some content creators just building huge audiences in the pandemic. And I'd be very curious to see if that's translating to, you know, purchases of album sales or like post-pandemic bookings. I'm also really interested in what might be happening for artists who and creative practitioners who previously couldn't access programs like unemployment insurance and have suddenly become eligible for income support like CERB, and what the impact is of that like relatively steady income source through the pandemic, and what kinds of creative work that's made possible.
To stay updated on the Brookfield Institute's work and to read the full report, visit brookfieldinstitute.ca. This is Sam Dharmasena, and you've been listening to CJRU 1280 AM in Toronto. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative, a project by the Community Radio Fund of Canada.